Okay, I'm starting the recording. Okay, so this is the PNI Institute call, Participatory Narrative Inquiry, for, you see, I really should find out what day it is before I do that. What is it, July? July 11th, okay, of 2018. And we're going to say who we are, or whoever wants to. I'm Cynthia Kurtz, and I do work in this area, and okay, somebody else.
I'm Murray McGregor, and I'm a storyteller in Ottawa, Canada.
Hello, I'm Stephen Sillett, and I do participatory theatre and community development, and I'm use PNI to help understand how projects can evolve.
Good, and we're expecting Harold eventually. Harold. Well, I would say Van Garderen, but he says something that I can't make out. Okay, so today we're supposed to talk about PNI and decision support. So before I, 5 minutes before I started looking, just typing in decision support, see if I can find anything to talk about, because I actually don't find that I have much to say about this because it's so diffuse. Like, it's almost like every PNI project is a decision support project in some way or another, that people are always making decisions. No matter what else you think you're doing, you're making decisions. So it's kind of hard to pick out anything to say about it. So what I did was I found actually some interesting sort of frameworks and kind of lists of things just on Wikipedia that I thought it would be interesting to talk about with respect to PNI. Is there anything anybody wants to say about it before we look at those, or do you have any other ideas?
No, that sounds good. I mean, the only thing I'd be interested in is this idea of maybe for the infusion, I've been looking at this idea of how things can inform. Like, people say, what's the point of doing stuff like exploring or inquiring? I wonder if there's also that point of personal, a point of learning and transformation, as well as decision support, that idea that it could be transformative in
some
way.
Oh, yeah, well, that's why I say that you almost can't pull decision support out as a separate thing, because you can't make decisions without making change, and you can't make change without making decisions. So it's kind of like we're sort of artificially pulling one thread out of the tapestry, but we have a reason to, because we want to talk about that. Okay, so one of the first things I found, I just typed in decision support, and I got this Wikipedia page, decision support system, and it mentioned a couple of taxonomies of decision support systems, and so I thought it might be interesting to look at those. So somebody named Hettenschweiler says they differentiate passive, active, and cooperative decision support system. That seems kind of obvious. It says here, passive DSS is a system that aids the process of decision-making, but that cannot bring out explicit decision suggestions or solutions. And then an active DSS can bring out decision suggestions or solutions, and then a cooperative DSS allows for an iterative process between human and system towards the achievement of a consolidated solution. So I'm thinking, where is PNI in those three categories? And as usual, I think it's all three of them, because it can be any one of them. It can be, I've seen it be done very passive in the sense that people talk about the stories and everything, but they never arrive at specific solutions. Maybe later, after a lot more thinking and maybe other processes, or people will follow it up with some thing like SWOT or other decision, like more specifically decision support things. But then I've seen people do it in a more active way where they actually come up with ideas and then start playing with them within the project. And then cooperative, if you have multiple projects and you cycle around and you gather your stories, you make sense of them, and then you do something and you keep monitoring it and you come back and do it again. excuse me. So I'd say that it could be all of them. And that's one of the kind of weird things about PNI is that, that's one of the things I like, is that it can be really tiny and small and tentative, or it can be huge and something that lasts for years and has lots and lots of people involved. So, and I don't like the idea of limiting it to any one of those things, because I'd like it to remain really flexible.
Could you paste those three things into the chat just so I can?
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Hold on. I'll just take the shortest version of it I can find. There. I mean, I would say that I've seen projects that match all three of those definitions. So, you know, it's like you can't say that BNI is any one of them. It's just that it could be any one of them. And people can choose, really, what they want to do. And there's nothing wrong with saying, well, we're not going to go all the way to decision-making with this project. There's nothing wrong with it. It doesn't mean you're doing it wrong. It just means that you're doing it, you're doing what you're doing. And sometimes, well, I think one of the things I try to tell people is that sometimes if you're not doing everything that you could potentially do, it's because you're not ready yet. Like whatever group or organization or community or anything is that, you know, there's a certain thing of being ready for things. And that sometimes people are like, well, we have to do it because we have this goal. But, you know, sometimes you just have to kind of work with the state of affairs, you know, and if you advance a step toward your final goal, that doesn't mean you're never going to get there. It just means that you can still make a big change and have transformation without getting from A to Z, you know.
Yeah, okay. I'm just thinking on what you're just saying there, because this idea of a passive system, I mean, you could also have more than one system. For instance, you could have the system of the intervention or the social service system. You could have the system of people's personal learning, you know, like the you could have multiple, you could almost see things maybe as having a few more systems at play.
I mean, I'd rather they didn't use the word system, really. It should just be decision support, period, as a verb. And as soon as you put the word system in it, you've limited it.
You've changed it to some extent, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, a system, I always say a system is a decision. It's a frame, you know, you draw a box around something, and that makes it a system. But you didn't really need the box.
Right. But it could also be this idea, because this thing is, there's the idea of a DSS. What does this decision support system? Mm-hmm. So you've got the system of doing the decision support, but then you've also got the system the decision making relates to. So like I could do something which is kind of fairly kind of learning orientated, which may relate to my system of learning around an organization. It may be like an evaluation, and then there may be another system which is like how it changes a project or a program or something like that. So I wonder how that fits in as well.
Well, you could say it's a system of systems. That might be the best description of what you're talking about, yeah. Well, that's why the word system is, I think, not all that useful, because people tend to then start thinking of the word system as meaning that it's something stable and something that actually exists versus, you know, just a frame that you made. You know, like you're holding, you know how people hold up their fingers to make a frame, you know, photographers, whatever, they do that, supposedly on TV. And then, you know, the problem is if you forget that those are your fingers, you know, and you start thinking that's the way things really are. And I think that happens a lot in projects, is that people do that, and then they forget that they made that choice, you know.
You tend to use the word system and everybody stops thinking.
Exactly. And that's why I don't really like the word. As soon as I hear it, I'm
done. So we've got it here, and then a little further down the road, you've got something that isn't part of the system, but now that you've got a system, you want to cram it in and make it fit in the box.
Yeah.
And without perhaps realizing that you are redesigning the so-called system,
yeah,
and you know, it's a restriction. It's a box. It's a restriction.
Yeah, and it also becomes a sort of sales platform. You know, it because we have a system. It kind of means we have things under control, and so it becomes something that gets harder to challenge because it's a package. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just don't like that.
I mean, it could be this idea, maybe a decision support frame.
I think that would be great. I mean, I think the word frame is a really useful word because I don't think that anybody has the idea that a frame is either static or sort of real. I'm like, I think the frame is something you put around something and you can take it off and change it. And, you know, people have an idea that you can take a picture out of one frame and put it in another frame and it looks different. And so I think that's a better word. Okay, so here's another taxonomy support. Should I go to that? I found, I think, four of these things that I thought would be interesting to look at. This is the second one. I'm going to paste it in the chat, and then I'll say what it says. They have whoever this is, Daniel Power. So he, and I think this one's really interesting. There's decision support systems that are communication-driven, which sounds to me like it's just mostly people talking. Data-driven, which means that you have a lot of data and you're looking at it. Document-driven, which I don't know what that is. It just seems like that's the same thing as data-driven, but I don't know. Then knowledge-driven, which is like expertise. And then model-driven, which is kind of like imagination, right? Because you're making these models and playing with them. And I would say that what PNI does is I would add another one here, which is experience driven. Experience driven. Because if you know, PNI looks into experience, and now I would say that the model driven is the imagination part, because there's a sort of imagination part of PNI that's in the sense making and everything. But when you're collecting stories, that's experience driven, which is not the same. I mean, I would say that PNI is communication driven. It's data driven because we do collect data. It's document. Well, I don't know if the document one, that seems redundant to me. It's knowledge driven because there's knowledge in stories, and it's model driven because people generate stories and do things with them. But I think what's missing in here is the experience driven, which is not the same as any of the rest of these. Because experience is driven is more like, what has this been like for you? Which doesn't fit into any of those categories. That make sense to you?
That makes sense. Actually, one thing that came up in a recent conversation, I was talking to a lady who used clean language for her PhD. Mm-hmm. I was mentioning about the use of, this is relevant, and it seems a little bit tangential, but it is relevant, is, you know, like when people use the infusion, like to use an embodied landscape to find stories about what they're thinking, or metaphors, depending on if it's like trying to look at the mechanism. But one thing that she said, which is interesting, is there could be a benefit in doing that. And I think that PNI kind of also addresses this slightly as well, in the way it opens, is if someone's doing something and they report on what they're actually doing, rather than trying to recount an actual event, there's less chance of cognitive bias kicking in. You're trying to think back and you've got a very particular lens. You know, it's hard to think back and things can be a bit distorted, but if it comes out an embodied experience in real time, I think PNI, maybe by the use of reflection and putting a title on the story and then multiple stories, and also allows a story to sort of, I don't know, recalibrate. It's not just stuck with what the story was that was first said as a recall device, but it's also starts to become alive. And for me, I'm interested in, even if that's a bit to the side, I'm interested in how, like, for decision support, I'm really interested if someone was to explore or navigate an embodied topography, how can that move towards, I can see it being useful for learning and for personal awareness around and transformation in a field, but to connect fields together, which is one of the things I was trying to do when I did that workshop at Design with Dialogue, I think it would really might be more likely to bring it together by harvesting all the different stories collected when people navigate their topographies and then use those as a way to interrelate things. But there, so there's a couple of things there, but this idea of how well people can recall events, and maybe this is where opinion over stories is also more problematic, because maybe opinion is more open to bias because you're locking it down earlier.
There's a lot there in what you said. I'd say one thing about it is that people say that often, well, you know, the way people remember things is distorted. And I'm like, well, yeah, then that's useful. Because if you look at the distortion itself, you can actually learn a lot from that. How is it distorted? How is what they remember different than the objective facts? You know, you can say, oh, that's a bias, but maybe bias is useful in the sense that if you pay attention to it, instead of just saying it's bad and we don't want it, what if you say, well, let's understand it. Let's look at how is it biased? How is it distorted? How is their memory shaped what happened to them? And I would say that, like, if you had the opportunity to observe people doing something in real time and getting their experience as it's happening to them, and then asking them about things in the past that were maybe similar, wow, that would be really fascinating. You know, like the juxtaposition of that, that would tell you so much. So I guess the problem is people are like, well, bias is bad, so we should just get rid of it. And I guess my experience is bias is information. Bias might be useful information, and we should not throw it away but explore it.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I think that's also where, though, if you're going for like strange attractors and sort of complexity, that you can sort of work with that. But whereas if people are going for singularity, looking for the kind of the point of the answer, then it could probably be disruptive. You know what I mean? So it's also partly in the kind of, I don't know if you'd call it a philosophy, but.
Well, I think you can get to answers from that. It's not a straightforward path, I guess. But, you know, if you're willing to take a sort of circuitous path, well, you have to be willing to do that if you're going to do anything with stories to begin with, because they are a circuitous path. That's kind of the whole point. You know, that if you ask people, what is your opinion, or, you know, rate your treatment of the doctor or whatever, you're going to get a direct path. But the circuitous path is going to take longer and surprise you and give you things that you've never guessed. And so, yes, you're going to get very different things. And I mean, I think of it as a complementary thing. Okay, let me just look at the next one. I wonder if I can just drag this. What will happen if I drag that? No, it didn't work. What if I do that? Hit return. Well, it did the link. And this is a famous, I was looking at decision support, and I kind of, there was another link for participation in decision making, and I was like, oh, cool, let's follow that. And I've looked at this before. This is a very famous thing. It's called a ladder of citizen participation. This was published by Sherry Arnstein in 1969, and this is quite a famous thing. It's called the ladder. It looks like a ladder. And at the bottom of the ladder, there is this category called non-participation, where this is where people say people are participating, but they're not really. The very bottom rung is manipulation, and then therapy. Now, I don't know what they mean by therapy exactly.
Yeah, I was just wondering myself. I just clicked, opened it here. Yeah,
not really sure if there's an explanation of that. I don't see an explanation.
I think the bottom two rungs are often left off the ladder. Because they were kind of a little bit, yeah, what does that mean? I mean,
I guess therapy
is really when you get into consultation that you're
into participation. Yeah.
Yeah. If it's got to the point where someone's manipulating, it's normally pretty obvious.
Well, but see, I think one of the reasons that they put it there is because that sometimes the things that the first two rungs are presented as participation, but they're not really. And I think that that's why it's kind of important to keep those there. I'm guessing that the therapy one is kind of like saying, we're going to help you make sense of this new change plan that is so great and you can't actually change the change plan. So it's kind of like helping people adjust to the thing they can't change.
Yeah, it's almost like the thing above it is informing. So if they're not informing, I mean, it makes sense, not with the higher levels of the thing, but I suppose if someone says they're informing, but really they're just trying to make people feel better,
yes,
or they're even manipulating, so they're not really even informing. And then if they are informing, but they say they're consulting, which is often what happens, they say they're consulting, but they're really informing.
Yeah, and I think a lot of these things, they say one thing higher up, and then it's actually something lower. So informing is when you're just telling people. Consultation is when you're asking them their opinion. Placation, I guess it's kind of pretending that they're having an impact and they're not. Maybe it's that you're giving them a little bit. Yeah, that's probably it. You're giving them a tiny bit.
I agree with that. Just giving them a tiny bit, yeah.
Of power.
What's the phrase? Throwing out whatever. I can't
remember.
No. Throwing a bone.
Oh, throwing a bone, yes. Yeah. Yeah. And then when they get to the three that are citizen power, you have partnership, delegated power, in that I allow you to do this for me, but I have checks and balances on you. And then the top one is straight citizen control. So my question was, where does PNI come in this? And I actually answered this a long time ago because I looked at it in some book that I was reading. And my answer was all of it.
Yeah.
Because PNI can actually be used for the non-participatory things. And I don't agree with those uses. But it has been used for that.
That's running a course, and then with the outcome predetermined by the people who are running the course, or whoever are paying them to run the course, or whatever. So you're both manipulating and placating, I guess, at the same time.
I would say that the majority of PNI projects are in the consultation. And maybe some placation. It's only the really courageous people that get up to like number six, and pretty rarely does it get up to seven or eight. So it's almost like a bell curve, really, across this ladder, is what I've seen. Oh, he's disappeared. That's okay. He's busy.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the interesting thing about this ladder, and I like the metaphor of the ladder, because it's always kind of like, can you move up another step? You know, wherever you are, you know, do you have the energy? Do you have the ability to move up? And it's kind of like a challenge to you. And also the verticalness of it, you know, like moving down is bad. And so I think that's why it's a nice... a nice metaphor for participation from the 60s.
That's when it all started, wasn't it?
Yeah, it is. And in fact, you know, I think
it's our modern concept.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff in social science and social work and social, like, community/organizational work that started in the 60s, and people are so unaware of it. You know, a lot of people, they just, these things have been kind of forgotten or become so backgroundy that people don't really talk about it. But there really was a lot going on. In fact, there was a lot of stuff going on in the story area I don't know about so much in the 60s, but the 70s, that people are just not really very aware of now. You know, everybody says, oh, this new thing, but it's not actually new at all.
I've actually had those same thoughts, and some of the reading I do, and I guess because I'm formally trained in history, 60 and 30 years or 50 years is not really that long.
No, it isn't.
And then you realize that that the whole this, you know, behavioral psychology, I mean, this, what they were doing in the 60s and what we're doing now, because as a storyteller, it's a field that I watch, it's a light and day, light years, light and day type of analogy. And there was nothing happening before the 60s. It was pretty basic stuff. It's a modern science, and which is why it keeps changing, because it's growing and trying to situate itself.
What always amazes me about history is that how short people's memories are. You know, I mean, obviously it's short because our lifetimes are relatively short, our productive lifetimes are, but it's like people just don't look back. I don't know why. And, you know, it's like people will be like, oh, there's this great new discovery that was made 50 years ago. And I'm surprised by how little people look back and how nobody calls them on it, you know? And if you try to call people on it, they're all like, well, what are you doing reading that old stuff, you know? I don't know. It's just strange.
Well, amongst the stories we tell ourselves, That's an actually, I have to think about that for a while. The near history story, the story from 30 years ago as opposed to 130.
Oh, yeah. I call it chronocentrism.
Call it what, sorry?
Chronocentrism.
Oh, okay. Interesting phrase. Yeah.
Like, what's it, ethnocentrism or geocentrism? Is it, you know, only your thing matters. And so people, like, there's this people talking about the great transition. And I forget what it has to do with, but I'm like, well, you know, it's not necessarily the great transition. It's our transition. That's what you really mean. Because everybody's transition has been great to them, you know. Actually, this was one of the first books I read that really kind of woke me up to this. There's a book called I don't know if you can see it there. Okay. The Age of Heretics. Now, see, that's backwards in my view.
Yeah, okay, I can read it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The Age of Heretics, and it's about heroes, outlaws, and the forerunners of corporate change by Art Kleiner, and it's about, I can't remember he has a timeline here, but I can't read it with these glasses. 40s, 50s, and he's got this really fascinating, I don't know if I can do it here, timeline of all these people who were active in all the stuff that we think is really recent, you know?
Yeah.
And I was so shocked reading it, because, you know, I was really deep into all the corporate change stuff, you know, and this is maybe 20 years ago, I was reading this almost, and I was like, what's this all in the 40s and the 50s, you know? So I think it's kind of the responsibility of anybody who wants to do this stuff to go back and read some of the history of these thoughts, because
they aren't now, or they're been improved on now, but they haven't been, you know, the original documentation. Yeah.
The same thing happens in the complexity field. Everybody's like, nobody ever thought of any of this before. And it's like, oh, come on. It's all there. It's not there in the form that it's there now, but it was still there. There are a lot of similar thoughts, you know. Anyway, sorry. That's one of my...
We're all on a tangent, but I think it's a good tangent. I've sort of, you know, sort of, I guess, plugged into the word complexity in the last year or so. At the same time, realizing that you know, what we've done is we've just coined the latest big buzzword.
Yeah.
And then it's sort of, you know, what I find amusing is this, to watch all the minor pundits sort of drop on it. Get on the bandwagon.
Oh yeah.
You know, and write their Me Too books, which I've stopped buying. Luckily, I live in a big enough city. We have a public library that I guess finds it a necessity to buy at least two or three copies of these things, and sooner or later I get to read them, because most of them are not worth $30, or $40 or whatever the price tag of the hardcover might be.
Yeah, there's a lot of relatively useless stuff being written.
That's my own cynicism coming out there.
Yeah.
I can have that because I got gray hair.
I guess that's one of the benefits.
Have you ever heard of something called charrettes?
Yes. Yeah.
And mm-hmm. Do you know where that comes from? Or that they're sort of inspired by?
Little cart. It's a French, like, carts.
Yep. It's an architecture phrase.
They use it in architecture.
Yeah, architects. They refer to charrettes as meetings about design, I guess.
Yeah.
It could be a public meeting as well. Not a matter of fact, in my context that I think of it is, it is more of a public meeting. And they call it a charrette. And they have, you know, working drawings, new project, whatever. I've been to a few. I was involved in heritage architecture protection in the city, an official committee for 7 years. So I've had my share of that type of material.
You know where that comes from, that term? Apparently the idea comes from like the 18th century. What used to happen back in the day is they used to go out with plans in a chest or something to the villages, and they would inform them on their development ideas, and they would go back to the crown.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of, so you know, you're talking about things in the past, but actually,
oh right,
there was a kind of participation back in the day, because the only thing is, I think the thing that's changed a lot now is most things were done at a local level with trades, and then things became industrialized.
Mm-hmm.
So there has been a big shift where things can't be done as organically through local people. You know, like, I don't know what it's like, but it, like, even in England, you've got a lot of times when you've got, you know, houses that have a little stone saying when it was built, or they all these little frills and stuff which were around back in the day. We've got rid of all that because it's all done through some design studio somewhere on a computer and just rolled out. You know, it's not the local craftsperson that really has that much input. So
control, yeah.
Well,
you got me looking for another book, and I have to alphabetize my books or something. But there's a great book called Masons, Tricksters, and Cartographers. Where is it? But it's a really great book about local knowledge, and it has this whole thing about how cathedrals were made before blueprints came about, and the way that the knowledge of how to build an arch and how to build this kind of thing and that kind of thing, and how it was kind of assembled through the knowledge and experience of these artisans, and that these really complicated buildings came about through the interactions of these artisans who understood how to put bricks together to make things. And it's really driving me crazy that I want to find this book now. I think it's called Masons something in Cartographers, but it really kind of, and there's a section of it that talks about contemporary science and how there's a lot more of that local knowledge and science than scientists admit, in the way that people work together and trade ideas and everything. And it's really fascinating look at what actually makes up knowledge and why people can come to solutions that work. And I'm going to just keep looking for this till I find it. Cause
mm-hmm.
Well, one of these days I'm going to get over the hump and organize all these things. Anyway, yeah, there's a lot of really fascinating literature about the way that we think differently now, but we never really did change much. And it's not that we actually think differently, it's that we kind of bought this idea that we think differently. And maybe it's pushed us to some extent in that direction, but it hasn't really worked because people have been still people. Does that make sense?
Yep.
I'll find it eventually. Anyway.
I just brought it up at Amazon.
Let me see. If I can. That's probably a better idea than looking on my bookshelf.
Yeah, David Turnbull.
Yeah.
Is the.
And of course, I have to suggest the book Trickster Makes This World is like one of the 10 best books I've ever read in my whole life. It's just an amazing book. It's about tricksters, the trickster figure, and how it's involved in so many things, and how it was a really big part of ancient knowledge, and how we've kind of forgotten about it, but it's still there. Anyway, it's just...
Well, the storytellers haven't forgotten about it.
Well, you're absolutely right. Yes. Yeah. And that's the kind of where it's hiding, you know, in the story.
It is hiding, yeah. I'm just making notes here because I've... tricksters are never far from my mind in terms of you know, performance story. And although I have to admit, I don't have a really good repertoire at the moment. But I do keep stumbling across them, and I do find them fascinating. And of course, we have the classic animal tricksters that are usually part of an indigenous culture. I'd love to find the tricksters of art culture, of our modern techno culture. Yeah.
Anyway. Okay. So yeah, I'm just putting those links in so that later on I will remember them. Because when I put in the audio thing, I like to put some links to the things we mentioned. Okay. So I want to get to this other thing because I found another Wikipedia page that talks about participative decision making, which I guess is a thing with a name, which a bunch of people have written about. But they had this interesting list that somebody wrote up, somebody named Van der Helm in 2007, independent futurist. He outlines 10 major advantages of participation, of participatory sense-making, decision-making. And each of them is a dilemma. And I thought, well, that's really interesting because I'd like to think about how does P&I address each of these dilemmas. So would you like to do that?
Yeah, put that out.
Okay, let me just paste it in the chat here. Can I do it? Okay. Oh, it didn't get the numbers, but oh, okay. Here, let me just put the link too, and then you can just look, scroll down to it too. Yeah, so the first one is participation as the answer and as the problem. That's a very interesting one. Because that, you know, the bottleneck of P&I is always getting people to participate, but it's also the solution. It also is the thing that makes it work. So it's the thing that makes it work and it's not work.
That's a good one.
Yeah, so I think that's actually, although I would always say that that's a good problem to have.
Yes. Well, I actually have found, because I've been reading up on this transdisciplinary teamwork,
mm-hmm.
a lot of times it involves some form of participation as the rationale for why you need to deal with local knowledge. Like, by bringing in participation, a whole load of things don't become viable. This idea of singularity starts to break down because... but it also... Yeah, by not having the nice, relatively convenient singularity to give you an answer, it lays that question, well, what do we do now that we've got participation? And presumably, participation often then starts to mean participation by people who don't all think exactly the same, as opposed to, you know, what happens with some of this tokenism. So participation, which isn't just like everyone agreeing in groupthink. You do, and P&I then comes in well, or potentially, but it does act like then. And we had this challenge. We did the work. We did the event down at Hamilton, where we did the show, and yeah, just collecting stuff afterwards isn't going to be so easy. But it may be. That's a consideration, you know.
Well, it's funny because they say that it's a disadvantage in the form of a dilemma, but I would not say it's a disadvantage or a dilemma. I would just say that it's a paradox.
Yeah, I mean, a dilemma is like a dilemma for who? It's, I suppose, what starts to come up. I mean,
yeah.
It's a dilemma in what way? I mean,
And I don't think it's a problem. I think it's it's kind of like just the nature of the beast, you know?
Yeah, I know. It's like this dilemma of, it seems to me like people say there's a dilemma. I need to have participation, but they're not telling me why. And then participation is difficult. And it's like, well, okay, but do you know why? It's like, you know what I mean? Like, participation is not just something you do because someone said it's a good idea. I think that can be, you know, what do you want people to participate? I think the biggest thing that separates P and I, and I think, is that the participants have some inkling at some stage into what you're actually trying to do with the stories.
Well, they should, if you're doing it right. Yeah.
Which is not, well, some forms of research actually, as we know, they say that's a problem. But that's, so I think that is where participation comes in. I mean, I suppose there's a bit of all or nothing. It's like, if you don't, if they only half know what you're trying to do, is it better they don't know anything?
So yeah,
that's maybe a little bit of a dilemma. How much do they know about what you do? That may be a dilemma.
It's a decision. I guess it's a dilemma, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess I think of participation. It reminds me of, if I can give an analogy, of my dog. Our current dog. I still say our current dog, even though it's been 5 years. She's part beagle. So beagles bark, right, a lot. And on the one hand, I really like to have a barking dog because it's protection against bears and people and things like that, right? And sometimes I'm super glad that the dog is barking. Like in the previous dogs, when they were very old and deaf, someone walked up to our house, came onto the porch, and knocked on the door. I was so shocked because that hadn't happened in 15 years. And I really like it that I know when a car is coming up the driveway because the dog tells me, right? But on the other hand, the dog also tells me about every movement of every squirrel and every little animal out in the, and an owl and a whatever, you know? And so it's like you got to take the good with the bad. And there is no solution. You can't have this kind of barking without the other kind of barking, right? Yeah. And the same thing is true with participation. If you're going to get people to participate, you're going to get people to participate, right? They're going to bark. So that's just what participation is. I don't think it's a dilemma.
I tell you what is, though, interesting, is, you know, your ladder of participation. Mm-hmm. There is a dilemma. How far do you place people up and down it?
Mm-hmm.
That could be.
Well, another thing about the ladder is that you may be pushing down and they may be pushing up. And so...
Or the other way around, you sometimes say people want people to go up and people just want to be informed.
Or some people are going up and it's not so much a ladder as a concourse, right? People are walking up and down the thing all the time.
That's true. Yeah. That is true. You might have some people this is true. There's that's true, actually. And you don't always get to decide. I mean, higher levels, they say the higher levels is not necessarily better. It's just what's appropriate.
Right.
I heard someone say that.
In context. Yes, I think that's true. I think that is true. Okay, so let's try and see if we can get through all these things. Let's see. Number two, the involvement of the actors. What does that mean? Okay, that just seems like the same thing as number one. Okay, we'll skip that. That's not important.
Yeah.
Number three, the level of ambition of the initiators, the context, and the participants. Okay, that's a dilemma. That seems like the same as number one again. I mean, that's kind of what we were talking about people running up and down the ladder and sort of smacking into each other.
Yeah, and what's the ambition? I mean, ambition is kind of expectation, but maybe that's a good one in a way. Ambition is expectation of where it could get to,
yes,
rather than where that's what it actually is at, which is also that actually is interesting. I've never heard that word used, but I think
it is appropriate. And in fact, I think sometimes ambition is something that is emergent in a project.
Absolutely.
It's surprising. Things can happen that no one had anticipated. And not only ambition, but there's a couple other things that come in. There's ambition and there's its opposite, which is sort of apathy. But then there's also a reaction to ambition, sort of, what would you call it? Somebody wants to have an ambition, but someone else doesn't want them to have that ambition. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's conflict for sure. But
It could be. I mean, this is where that idea, it depends how positive things are. I mean.
Yes, it depends on whether there's trust, whether people believe that they're working together for something, or whether they're working against each other. Because ambition can be collective, it can be individual, it can be this group versus that group. It's a very interesting word because there's a lot of sort of buzz in it. Okay, so I'd say number three is a very interesting one.
I like it because it also gives that option of, often people say, what do people think or what do they want? And I say, well, ambition could be, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like ambition gives you, it's a bit like expectations, but possible expectations as well. You can, it's like, what's the ambition?
I think another word that relates to that is energy. Like a lot of times when people are designing a project and they're trying to decide what they're going to do, I'll say, where's the energy? Mm. Where's the energy that you want to tap into? And where are energies that you would rather not? Because there are negative energies that are going to be hostile or you know, then what does that mean? You know, why is that energy there? What should you do about that? Ambition is one way to think about it, but energy is also... Well, energy is sort of I would say that ambition is a sort of subset of energy. That there may be several kinds of energy, of which ambition is one of them. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see. Number four, representation and legitimization. I can never say that word. Participation works best in a situation where it is not needed. i.e. in an environment in which all interests are taken into consideration. Well, that is true. That's a really interesting paradox, isn't it? Participation works best in a situation where it is not needed.
Where what participation is not needed?
Yeah. That's very interesting.
I don't quite get that.
No, what it means is that if everyone can participate, if everyone has a voice, it works best, but in situations where participation is not needed, I mean, where participation is needed, it's tending to be, it's needed because it's not working. Mm. And so it's not going to work, even if you make it work, right? I mean, maybe it will work, but it won't work as well.
No, I hear what you're saying. It's like, yeah, that makes sense. Or for instance, say you've got a group and people are meeting to share stories and get insights so we can move forward with the project. Mm-hmm. So participation is needed to move forward with the project. But if participation is needed just for someone to even have a voice and feel valued,
exactly,
that becomes that could get in the way. That could get in the way. But it doesn't necessarily mean you can't still do your project, but it could get in the way.
Well, say you contrast two situations. Situation A is one where you have a tight-knit community where everyone feels respected and equal and they have rights and whatever. And everyone knows everyone else's needs and everything so well that you could ask one person, right? And you would get what everybody needs. You would get an understanding of everything. And in that case, the participation of everyone is not needed because you can ask one person. Because they're already participating. They're already connected to each other in such a way that it's like holographic, right? The little piece is indicative of the whole, or maybe it's like a fractal where the small piece is like the big piece, right? Self-similar. But in a situation B where people are kind of divided and they don't know each other very well and they have theories about each other, but their theories are wrong, there is a situation where participation is really needed, but then it's hard to create.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Oh, no. Oh, good. Got it.
It's a little bit vague, but they're trying to say it in a very few words, I suppose.
Yeah, but I think it's a really interesting, because it has to do, this number four has a lot to do with, this is something you should take into account when you're designing a project, because you need to know, what is the situation like? How are things already working?
I was thinking, it's a matter of level of trust at that point, that participation. Yeah. You don't have some level of trust amongst the different people, groups, it doesn't work.
Okay, see, number five, knowledge, power, and strategic behavior. Now, I hate ones like that because what does that even, it's just a bunch of words. I mean, what does that mean? How is that a dilemma? How is knowledge a dilemma? I don't even know what they mean by that. I mean, if they say a dilemma, they should say two things that are balanced, right? I don't know what to do with that. So I see number six, it makes more sense. Formalism or freedom. Now that's a dilemma, right? That's the complex, complicated thing, right? Formalism is structure, and freedom is, the lack of structure. And that's a really interesting thing to think about in participation. Because sometimes formalism or structure is really helpful and needed, and sometimes it's destroys things. I don't know how PNI reacts to that. I would say that it actually reminds me of recently I was talking to somebody about a project they wanted to do, and they had done a lot of little story workshops with people all over the world in factories, and they were saying they wanted to kind of get an idea of how things were different in different places or what concerns people had or whatever. And they said, well, it's probably not good to use a survey, because it's so uniform. And I said, well, sometimes uniformity is a good thing. And, you can use a little bit of uniformity and it can mix in with the contextualness of things. And, it's like sometimes people get so focused on freedom and complexity and emergence and everything that they forget that a little dose of regularity can actually be really useful, and that this interaction between regularity and emergence can be more beneficial than one or the other by itself. So I would say I would not say that that's a dilemma. I would say that that's a recipe. You know what I mean? Number six.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, what's the nicest mix? When you're making bread or something, you have a feeling for what mix is the best one. Like, for an example, like my recipes, I tend to have just a heap of sticky notes in my cookbook for the things I like to make most. And every time I make it, I'm thinking, do I want to adjust this a little bit? How did it come out this time? Maybe I want to try something. And so I have all these recipes going back for decades where I made little tweaks each time. And so the mixture I use now is not the mixture I used 20 years ago because I just keep playing with it. And so that I think this number six is kind of an opportunity to sort of find the mix that works. And I think it would be an interesting exercise to think about that. But I wouldn't say it's a dilemma or a disadvantage of participation. That makes sense?
Yeah. I mean, there's some assumptions going in here, which are kind of, it's a bit of a rife with participation. It's like,
I think that this list is not it's a list of dilemmas. It's a list of interesting things to think about that will help you figure out what you're going to do when you're designing participation.
So.
And I think for that, well, some of them don't get me anywhere. Like number one, number three, number four, number six so far, one, three, four, and six, have I think are like food for thought. They're like seeds that would really get your thinking going. Let's see if we can continue.
I suppose these are things which don't get so central when you don't have participation. You could say that as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If you don't have participation, then these things probably don't. Like formalism versus freedom. Well, that's irrelevant if there's no participation. That's just, you know, that's how you're going to design the car, right? It's not how you're going to design the drive. It's the aesthetic of it. It's your choices. It's, you know, that sort of design. It's not the same as designing something that people are going to do. Number 7, entering the debate between timing and perseverance. I guess the person who wrote this would be able to explain it better. I don't see how timing and perseverance are opposites. Yeah, I don't get that one. Maybe it's a language thing. This person wrote in Dutch originally. I mean, perseverance is an aspect of timing, isn't it? Isn't it subsumed under timing?
Well, I mean, maybe it's that idea that you're going to stick with it. You're not going to just let people down. But, I mean, it really depends if that is...
I guess you could argue that timing means choosing the right time to do the right thing, and perseverance means ignoring the right time, just plugging ahead. Maybe? It's hard to guess. Well, I would say the timing is extremely important.
Timing and perseverance. Entering the debate between timing... Well, maybe there's this idea of timing means things don't take forever, so things happen relatively quickly, and perseverance means you're willing to stick with something to get what you need. So maybe that's a dilemma. Which one do you do?
Oh, yeah, I suppose you could say that. Like, maybe timing is sort of setting limits on things, and it's kind of like setting fixed deadlines and saying this is the schedule versus... we're going to just play it out as long as it takes. Although, I would say that's just number 6 again. Structure versus freedom again. Mm-hmm. It's just a repetition of that in a time way. Let's see. Going beyond information. Communication and mediation. Well, you know what that is. That's the latter. Number 8 is the latter participation. Mm-hmm. Did you say?
Yeah, it's funny why they've chosen mediation as the word, but...
Well, again, it may be a translation issue. Okay. Oh, I like number 9, results and non-results. Now, that is an interesting thought, because that is something that comes up a lot in designing projects and also in evaluating projects of did we achieve what we meant to, because... people talk a lot about results and did we get results? And there's a lot of discussion over what constitutes a result and what doesn't. Like, for instance, if people had a great time at the sense-making session and came out of it feeling like they're more connected as a community, is that a result or is that not a result? And that word result is very connected to sort of qualitative or quantitative research that produces results, but only certain things can be considered results. So the question of what is a result and what is not a result, what is an acceptable result, what is an expected result, I think that would be a really great thing to use to talk about in respect to participation. Oh, and number 10 is kind of the same thing, appreciating and apprehending success and failure. I would lump those together because they're kind of the same thing. Like I was saying, what is a result? What is an acceptable result? Which is the same thing. And in fact, that's one of the things I often try to do when I'm getting people to plan projects is I will say, describe this project succeeding really well. What happened? And then when people in a group do that, they can be really surprised. Like one person can be surprised at what the other person said, or sometimes people can surprise themselves at what they think would be a success or a failure. So, okay, so looking at this list, I would say that this kind of like comes to a cool things to think about when you're thinking about a P&I project list, and it's like, this is cool. So I'd say number one is, how is participation the answer? Let me see if I can do this. One, how is participation the answer in this project, and how is it the problem, right? So number two would be, what is the ambition of each group in the project and the context and the project itself? So I don't, that's not really perfect. But. And then let's see, three, let's, how do we do that one? I would say this just like this, participation is best. What was it again? I have to keep switching. When it is not, how does that statement, what does that statement mean with respect to this project? That's very cool. I'm sorry that we kind of slid into participation here from decision making, but it's just, I don't know. Okay, so then, formalism of freedom. So that one is, what mix of structure and freedom would you like to create for this project? Yeah, so then, let's see, formalism of freedom. I don't... This timing one, well, I think the good question there would be like, how do you see time in this project? How would you like to structure time or not structure it? That, I think that makes sense. Then if the number, what is it, six? Six, look at this ladder of participation and talk about it with respect to this project. Then number seven is, okay, this is, yeah. What kind of result do you think will come out of this project? What would be a non-result? What would be an acceptable result? What would be unacceptable? What would be a success? What would be a failure? Now that's a cool, that's a nice list of seven interesting questions to ask yourself when you're planning a project. That's cool. And of course, the problem is that this would work for any project, whether it's about decisions or not. See, that's why this topic is a difficult topic, because I don't think there are any projects that don't have anything to do.
Well, you know, it's interesting though, because, well, say your project is an intervention. See, well, for me, I'm quite interested in this idea of P&I intermingled with an intervention, right? So there's, what I found is working with youth, for instance, on behavior change. You're looking for them to get knowledge in that, but maybe they're not going to make decisions. They're youth, you know, although they're going to make decisions in their lives.
Right.
So when we say decision-making, we kind of really mean collective decision-making.
Yeah, I think I always mean that, yeah.
Yeah, so well, but when you're doing it with adults, it's different. Or even youth, if you're doing something where you're trying to... Well, the problem I find is this unrealistic expectation, like, oh, you're doing that, that looks interesting. Okay, so... So what comes out of it? And it's like, well, hold on. Like, it's enough that they can just explore it. Now we can maybe get to decision making. Maybe we need to do a round two, or just you know, because like, holy shit, we can't fix the world's problems in a 3-day workshop. You know, like there might need to be a few, or even a project might need a few things stacked up against each other. So I think that there is a question there when it moves to decision support. When is it that you allow that to be not central because the capacity building is central? And then maybe there's a point in time where it's like, okay, really this time we're going to structure it because we need to make a decision to justify what we're doing and why we're doing it.
Right.
Maybe it has to be a different set of expectations, and it may be slightly differently orientated when you are converging, if that makes sense, rather than generating. And I think with P&I as well, I imagine it's more in the sense-making stage. I might be wrong.
Oh, that's when you're getting to the close to decisions. I mean, I always call it the stage where you're coming out of sense-making, where you're kind of like walking out the door on the other side of sense-making is when you start making decisions. And it seems that it's kind of inevitable.
Mm-hmm. But you could be making decisions about how to proceed with the P&I learning, how to inform. I suppose there's decisions within the program internally and how to grow and develop. Like happened with us and our project down in Hamilton, we decided that we'd focus on the first part of the work. You know, these three areas gave us something to focus on when out right. of the myriad of things. And then the question becomes, oh, how does that inform your decisions thing outside of your project?
Well, I think decisions are made in order to do the project are kind of meta, and they're not really what we're, you know, talking about when we talk about decision support. I think what I'd say is that it's legitimate to say, I mean, we set up these calls because we were going to talk about P&I used for all these different things, but I think the thing we have to remember is that it's hardly ever used for any one of them all by itself. That what can happen is one can kind of dominate the other ones so that you can have a project where it's like 70% decision making. I'm not sure it ever can get much higher than that. And I'm not sure that the proportion of decision making can ever get below much below 30 or so, or 25, because, you know, there are certain things that are just kind of inevitable because you have people talking and making sense of things. And so it's more a matter of mixtures of things than of what is the purpose of this project. And I think that's part of doing projects with people is kind of educating them about the fact that you can't just say, we're going to do X and that's the only thing you're going to do. And that's part of the participatory thing. It's part of participation is that when you involve more people and you give them more they can do, you mix in things whether you wanted to or not. And it's like you said about the singularity. You know, if it's single, it's simple, it's uniform, it's internally uniform. And so you can control that. But as soon as you start spreading it out and involving all these people and actually giving them some choices that impact the way things go, you've lost control of your single purpose. And that's the participation being the answer and the problem at the same time. This is a really cool concept.
I'm just aware of your time.
Yeah, now it's 3:30. And I think it's probably good to, do you guys feel like we've treated this to some extent?
No, I think this has been valuable, actually. Yeah. I mean, we've got more than enough material here to try and integrate.
Yeah, and I think it's a really interesting discussion. I mean, it's funny because I just sort of randomly fell onto a couple of criteria or whatever that people had written up. And, you know, we could have arrived at some other randomly chosen set of criteria, but that's one of the reasons I love it when people make frameworks like this. Because you just in your environment to kind of play with. If nobody ever did this, if nobody ever said, here's three of these or here's 10 of these, then it would be harder to think about stuff. You need stuff to bounce off of, you know? So I think that's a great way of
absolutely. And it's not, I mean, I know you're saying, semi-random. I mean,
no, it's not.
It has its reasons. Yeah. It got you. So, but yeah, I know what you're saying. So you're right. And Layla's been very good. She's been the whole time here. So, good girl. She got a bottle, so she was happy.
Okay, no, well, I'm going to stop the recording. Okay, I'm going to stop the recording.
And I'm going to try.